excited by this one. This is The Art of Wasting Time, brackets, and how not to. And there's elements of this filmed on location, so to speak, fueled, I think, in your own words, entirely by curry and, I was going to say curry and rum, but it was no rum, curry and cake.
Cake and curry. Cake
I'd
and
hoped
curry.
There was rum, but there wasn't.
I didn't get any. If there was, I didn't get any.
No. But this one is going to be a good one. I've still not got the hang of this. Who or what we introduce first? If we introduce the episode, if I introduce myself, for those who haven't listened to the previous three now episodes, and
yeah,
absolutely bloody should have done.
Do it quicker. Do it in 5 seconds though, Ben. Oh, I've given you 10 before. Okay. It's 5 seconds now.
Here we go. Ben Williams, work for Luprino Foods. We make mozzarella. I make sure it's sustainable, farm to customer.
So close, so close. I'll take the 10 seconds though. So I'm Helen Brooks, Head of Business Development at CL. So CL is the livestock focused agri-tech centre across the UK. And yeah, it is today, the word is lean, which is absolutely Ben's number one favourite topic in the world. It feels like every conversation we have, Ben, has an element of lean management in it. So yeah, what are we really talking about when we talk about lean?
So, we've talked in previous podcasts that none of our farmers wake up thinking, I'm just going to give up and I'm going to grind my business into the ground, despite the fact that we all wake up having bad days. So we're all trying to be as efficient as possible. And we have these people, and I use a very derogatory term, which I can't say on a podcast that's going out, but it's basically sort of a bad mechanic. Bad isn't the phrase I use.
No.
But imagine a bad mechanic. And they've turned up and there's a car that's not running at its most efficient. It could be better. And they wander around, they kick the tires, they look at the owner of the car and go, do you know what's wrong here? This needs to be more efficient. And then they promptly leave without telling the person who owns the car how it can be more efficient, not helping them make it more efficient, not fixing the problem.
And not supporting them to do so.
Yes. And I feel as an industry, and I think I've done it as well, more than I should have done. I think we stand in front of farmers at conferences and events and in other podcasts and various other bits and pieces. And we talk about sort of, you know, how can farmers become more sustainable, business sustainable and planet sustainable and people sustainable. And the word efficiency comes up in every single one of them. And you'll hear these people go, do you know what? The best way for your business and for the planet to become more sustainable is efficiency. And we're like, yeah, okay.
Yep.
Brilliant. But that asks how. Yeah, how? And there's lots of different ways you can become more efficient. But I don't think the answer is more technology. I don't think the answer is more data, although a bit of extra information is definitely the way to do it. I genuinely think if you're going to ask somebody to be more efficient, you need to support that efficiency. You know, nobody knows what they don't know. And so lean management is a framework. It's a management framework. It's been used in lots of other industries that have faced similar needs to change at rapid pace, that have struggled with elements of volatile markets and profitability and various other bits and pieces. And it's made a massive difference. We tried it a little bit in pigs. It was trialed very successfully. And I will name check this individual, by a lady called Grace Emeny at AHDB, who did an amazing program called Smart Hort. And it made a huge difference. So my thought was, could it make a difference in dairy? And we've been trialing a pilot, which has been very successful. So we're obviously on location at a lean farm.
We are.
Very exciting. Reynolds and Rachel Harries. I'm not going to pronounce the farm because I know you have fun doing it in the podcast. So I'm going to let you crack on with that one.
Thanks.
But it's a beautiful sort of 175 cow springbok calving, the rolling Welsh countryside. It's a beautiful place. It's an incredibly well-run farm anyway, but we've been trying to see if we can find more efficiency. And joining us obviously on the farm is Dan Humphreys from a company called Dairy Insight. Dan's a farm vet by practice, but he's been filling in an important gap actually in the learning journey we've been using for our structure. We're also joined by a chap called David Crowfoot. David is part of a company called Fed and USP, who were originally part of Smart Hort. They then moved into the pig equivalent, cunningly named Smart Pork. You'll see what's happening here. We haven't called it Smart Dairy because that's already copyrighted, but
it's
smart and it's dairy based. Yeah. So, you know, if it walks like a duck,
it is a duck.
And yes, so we have a chat. We're also to set a bit more of a scene, we're also joined by a gentleman who I would say needs no introduction, but he often suggests he does, and that's Michael Blanche of the Pasture Pod.
Yep.
Who obviously he went on his own quest to look at lean management and what it meant and where it fit and various other bits and pieces. But for him, it was all about sort of finding that time, you know, and valuing time itself, because it's one of those things that we have a funny relationship in farming. You know, if you're not working, you're not successful.
Not successful, yeah.
You know, and we need to sort of, yeah, look at that mindset a little bit.
Now, I think this podcast is going to be one of those ones. So I was listening to a podcast the other week about the unknowns, and we have the known unknowns and we have the unknown unknowns.
So I'm hoping
today that we fall into both of those camps. So I hope that there are people that have heard about lean and like lean management, you know, may have had smart pork, smart whore, or obviously come into contact with the Leprino dairy sort of project. And there will be those that go, what? Hang on, not a clue. So I'm hoping today we fall into those known unknowns and the unknown unknowns.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's really great to have all of these. To be on farm is brilliant. So let the fun begin.
Definitely. Let's crack on.
Welcome everyone to today's podcast. We are really grateful to be on farm today at Rachel and Raynite's farm in Clemende Farm. God knows if I've said that correctly, but I'm hoping everyone will correct me if I haven't. So Raynite, maybe you can just introduce yourself and introduce the farm a bit to those who are listening before I introduce the rest of the panel for today's podcast.
Yes, thank you. Welcome. Yeah, so a farming partnership here with my wife Rachel in Bethlehem, the Towy Valley, Carmarthenshire. A spring calving herd, calve about 180 cows, sort of grass based system. So that's sort of the crux of it. Yeah.
Okay, Doc. And how long have you been on the farm?
We spring 17 is when we calved first. Then we did a bit of work here, or summer autumn 16, getting the farm close to ready, and then relatively new to the game. Yeah.
Brilliant. Perfect. So. Also with us today, David, can you just introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm David Croper. I'm from Fedden USP and a lean consultant. Been doing lean for a long time, about 20 years, started in manufacturing, and more latterly worked in agriculture and horticulture.
Fantastic. And Dan?
I'm Dan Humphreys from Dairy Insight. I'm a dairy vet by trade, but I do a lot of consultancy and work with a lot of dairy farmers across the UK and further afield.
Brilliant. And as always, we have Ben with us as well. So Ben, maybe just first question to you. We're here to really talk about lean management and lean management processes. So maybe just a bit of an overview in terms of the role that you see lean taking part within the business.
I will do. I mean, lean should need no introduction because it's the most exciting principle the world has ever seen, obviously. But lean for us is, for Leprino, is one of those things that sort of, we talk about efficiency in the supply chain and we work hard in the factories to drive efficiency and various other bits and bobs. And we often tell farmers to be efficient. You know, these people that turn up and sort of, you know, wag their fingers at farmers and suggest, you know, the simplest thing they can do for sustainability is be more efficient. And then we sort of leave without really telling them how or supporting or guiding in any way, shape or form. And it just got a little bit frustrating to be that person stood there and saying that. And I have done it and I just didn't want to. So lean became sort of the trial of something we could try and do and see if that actually helped the efficiency. So that was the point and the purpose, and was really sort of where David came in, who probably is better suited than me to give a bit of a sort of introduction for those who don't find lean as exciting, a sort of headline of the greatest thing in the world.
Okay, I'll try and make it exciting then. But
no pressure.
So very quickly, so lean's a manufacturing technique that came from Toyota, actually came from a number of techniques about how you improve processes. Toyota picked it up post-war and were able to implement these techniques. And then it was really documented by Womack and Jones into something called lean thinking in the 90s and started to be applied across the world. Start to move into service sector. And I think, you know, from an agriculture and horticulture perspective, I think for the sort of last 10 years, we've been applying it in these sectors. So I could talk you through what the basic principles are without going on about it for too long. Would that be?
Yes.
Yes.
Please.
Please. I'll try and make it as exciting as quick as possible. So So it's made up of five key principles, Lean, which are fairly simple to understand, but most of everything we do are based on these five principles. So the first being, we always define value in terms of the customer. So the customer defines the value in any process. So we have to be clear what's the thing that makes value. So we'll maybe come back to that within dairy. The next thing is to understand where that value sits within the value stream. So that's the end-to-end process. After that, once we've understood value and understood where it sits in the value stream, there's lots of things that happen that aren't value, that are things that we call waste or non-value add. And we try and remove those to make the processes flow better. So that's the third principle, is about flow. The next one is about pull. This is slightly harder to get the concept into agriculture and horticulture, but it's about pulling to customer demand. So making sure we're only making things when the customer requires it. And then finally, the last one is perfection. And this is about continuous improvement and moving towards perfection. So that's the five principles. All of Lean tools, etc., that come should be based around the application of those five principles.
There is, before we move on a little bit, you talked about Lean tools, we talked about Lean principles. There are those that would use elements of Lean tools and say that they're Lean without following the principles and make sure your toolkit flows through those principles. Is there a risk of perhaps doing something, it working a little bit, going wrong, and then going, well, this Lean doesn't work?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's lots and lots of techniques, and there's lots and lots of tools. In fact, there's a book called The Lean Toolbox, which I think there's about 800 or something tools within it.
That's a lot of tools.
So there's
the Snap-on man would love that one.
Yes, there's a lot of tools.
A full arctic of tools.
And so, their application, I think they do deliver some good in single, in if they're applied, most of the tools, but without the context of the principles, they can be misplaced, I think, and that's where sometimes. Sometimes these applications, it doesn't work.
You'd lose that flow, wouldn't you? Which is a real core.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, there's lots of good solid techniques that people apply, but if they're not based on the principle and not the context of the business or particularly the sector, they end up just being tools applied to anything. So there's lots about, for example, one of them is called 5S or workplace organisation. It's a thing that most Lean consultants apply in most places, and it has its benefits. But in the context of a different business, it might not have the same benefits as somewhere else.
It could just be tidying up.
Yeah, it could just be seen as tidying up, and doesn't get sustained and actually doesn't really make a whole big benefit to the whole process. If you're certainly within lots of agriculture where labour isn't the biggest cost often, just thinking about labour isn't necessarily the right thing to do. So that's why we go back to applying the principles first, and that's certainly what we've done within dairy, is think about the principles and then we apply the tools based on the principles.
Okay. So, Dan, in terms of applying that to dairy and the dairy sector?
Yeah, I think I've been really interested with this programme right from the start, because I've always worked with a lot of farmers who are really driving for efficiency. And I agree with Ben's comment at the beginning that so often it's the old pigeon consultant analogy, which I won't fully explain in this because it's got swear words in, but you arrive on farm, make a mess everywhere and leave. But tell people, hey, Reynard, you need to be more efficient. You want to make some money, be more efficient, without actually being able to provide anything that's going to give the tools to do that. And the Lean framework has been fantastic for doing that. I think one thing that's important to understand when we're working with farms and in this industry is we're probably working with a population that's 100% bandwidth, like on so many different job levels, animal health, mechanics, like horticulture, agronomy. It's all happening at the same time, that there is not a lot of bandwidth there. So when you're trying to implement a change process on farm, we actually need additional bandwidth first. So we either have to add bandwidth, or we have to make the existing processes more streamlined to the point where we can get that bandwidth back. And working in these teams to actually start to try and contextualize Lean into dairying has been really good, to actually be able to provide a framework for asking some of the questions about what is it that we're trying to achieve in a more defined manner. Often actually a process that doesn't happen that much on farm. From a day to day, the jobs are just happening, so people will continue to do them and get paid, and obviously sometimes not get paid enough, but they'll continue to do them. But this gives an opportunity, defining value by actually going back, which are the steps in this which are important, which are the things that deliver value, either financial or there are other values in a business. And then once you've actually started to identify those things, which are a little bit different on a lot of the farms, but they are quite similar context over and themes overall that we can talk about in a little bit, then which tools are most appropriate. So we can start to actually use things like DMAIC problem solving to give people the tools to actually look at a problem themselves after we've long gone. The idea is not that we continue to do this, is that we actually engender people with a skill set that means, right, I can go through this with a process and I can get a really good result out of it because I know it, how to do it now. And as we've gone on with lots of different farms, that is, those processes have looked different. Mm-hmm. But like I say, the real objective of it is actually when people understand the process, they can apply it to a lot of the things they can do and start to build that extra bandwidth and resilience into their businesses, which they can then use to apply for some more efficient processes at the end of it.
So you can't tell me that everybody is ready for lean, surely, Ben?
No, I'd be lying. That's certainly true. But I think farmers at their core are efficiency-driven business people. They'll also sort of have lifestyle drives and demands and bits and pieces, but none of them wake up thinking that they're going to have an inefficient business. I think really, though, we can discuss that a bit with Michael Blanche, who has looked into that urge of what do we need to do to build a better business.
I'd like to welcome Michael onto the podcast. Michael, thank you ever so much for your time today to talk to me and to Ben. Michael, can you just maybe introduce yourself, your farm, and a little bit of background to yourself to those people listening today?
Yes, thanks, Helen. Hello, everyone. My name is Michael Blanche, and I am 54 years old. I have got
54 years young.
Yeah, yeah. I've got 11 years left of farming.
Really?
Tick-tock. Right. So I am a first generation farmer. I'm a first generation farmer, and I set. So we were 8 years in seasonal lets. We tried seven times to get a tenancy and failed. We started off with a balance transfer from my credit card to buy sheep. Eighth year of trying, eighth attempt, we got a tenancy, and that tenancy will run until I'm 65.
Right, okay.
We are cattle and we are sheep, and I don't have a tractor, and I do some consultancy, and I do a podcast, which I often say is a vanity project, which there's a little bit of truth in that, because on the normal podcast, I sing my own theme tunes, a different one every time. And I used to have a talking dog that told jokes, but she passed away. So we're going to try and get her back. We're going to get a medium involved and try and get back so she can tell the jokes.
We don't actually have a theme tune for the podcast. And so there might be a commission, Michael. There might have to be, mightn't there?
Yeah. The theme tune is in. I mean, hopefully by now, with everybody listening, we'll have a theme tune and it'll be seamless.
That's true.
Michael, you could be on every single podcast with a theme tune. Who knows?
I could just do the theme tunes for every podcast.
Exactly.
There's a part of me that is absolutely loving that, Michael, absolutely loving that. I mean, it seems like we've sort of got some sort of podcast inception here, because we're talking about a podcast on a podcast. Possibly we're going to talk more about another podcast, and then there'll be some. We'll see how many times we say the word podcast. It's going to be a lot. But picking up on said podcast, the Pasture Pod, I'll plug it for you. I'll do that right now. There was one particular sequence of that Pasture Pod that had a very definitive purpose. And that purpose was time. In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, it was called It's About Time.
Yeah. Do you see what I did there?
See what you did there. I liked it. It's the entire reason I listened, and then I stayed for the theme tune and obviously the incredible jokes. We've talked a little bit about that. You've been kind enough to sort of come and join us in some conversations with the farmers and bits and pieces. The obvious question is, why did you make a podcast series about time? You know, when you've got other stuff to do.
There were a variety, it was a perfect storm. So there were just, I don't know what it is. And it is a wee bit like Inception, but there are different things that happen in your life that come together and mold. And then I thought, well, I'm going to have to do something about this, because it's, first of all, I was on, I'm on a private Facebook chat about shedding sheep. It's very special interest.
It is niche.
Niche.
But there's an Australian on that called Andrew Freshwater who is blunter than a blunt thing and told, it's largely a UK Facebook page, and he said, from the outside looking in, you guys are going to have to address seriously labour efficiencies. And he's really concerned about us. And everyone, I think it got my back up, but it also, you know, he was talking about 5,000 to 6,000 ewes per person. Per person.
Yeah.
And that's how you made money. You did the sums. It did look really good on paper. But how do you actually do that? That's a big question. And then I also followed this lady called Kath Morley, who's a dairy farmer in Lancashire. And she was in Farmers of the UK for a whole week. She was really honest. She just said how difficult things were, like 13-hour days, 7 days a week. It was crippling. It was emotional. It was, you know, she would quite often cry in the shed. And I thought, I know more Kath Morleys. There are a lot of Kath Morleys around. Just absolutely all-consuming, and there's just not enough time. And just generally in consultancy, I speak to people, and they're, you know, part of the business plans that I do for people, it really centres on a vision, where they want to be, what they want to do, and it almost all revolves around time. And all these things came together, and I realised that actually time is... Yeah, there's so many analogies that I made up that didn't hit the nail on the head. But things like life is not like a box of chocolates, but a chemical compound, and time is an absolute essential element to that compound that we don't see, we don't fully appreciate. It's also like an iceberg. It's just like the tip of the iceberg. We know time is there. We know it's kind of important, but we do not think about that any more than that. When we assess, like we went to a conference, didn't we, Ben? Quite recently.
We did. One or two.
Every conference is the same. You go there, you learn about technical and financial issues of farming, maybe some sort of marketing or customer relations or what the customer wants, all that sort of stuff. But time is not mentioned at all. And yet it is I would say it's the third dimension of farming, I would say, and yet we never mention it.
It's bonkers. Do you think the value, I completely agree, it's bonkers. Do you think the value we put on time changes as we move through our years and through our careers and that type of thing? Do you see that? I thought about that before I said it. Do you see what it does?
Yeah,
it definitely does. And what my motivation personally for the podcast was to, so I have, well, first of all, it's quite finite. I have until I'm 65. That's all I've got left of farming. So that's 11 seasons, 11 lambings, 11 calvings. I joked that it was 10 disappointing forage crops, and, you know, count that in two hands, all that sort of stuff. But it's not a lot. It is absolutely not a lot. And then as you get closer to that thing, you realize it isn't a lot, and you realize it more, and urgency becomes more and more to the fore.
I mean, there must be, I mean, talk about a kick in the teeth. There must be a real kick in the teeth then when sort of jumped up little oiks who aren't part of the farm or sat further up the supply chain, me, basically, sort of wander down a farm drive and turn around and go, do you know what would really help you if you were more efficient?
Yes.
Yeah, that must be very frustrating. I can honestly say, as somebody who's guilty of that, actually, I have with absolutely no sense of irony, looked farmers in the eyes and said, do you know what will help you with this whole sustainability malarkey? Being more efficient. I get sick of that. I genuinely get sick of that. And we've talked about the analogy of the ship mechanic. You know, that sort of person that walks up to your car, you know, the business in this case, kicks the tires, tells you that you need to fix it, be more efficient, and then just leaves. As if you didn't know the damn thing needed a little bit of pep or various other bits and pieces. Seagull consultants, I've heard them called. That was the other phrase. Or pigeon consultants. Turn up, crap everywhere, leave. Don't make any difference.
So that really sets the scene on why we may need a different approach to supporting farmers with finding efficiencies of all varieties on farm, but also raises the question of how do you lean or leanify a dairy farm?
Leanify, it should be a new word. It does take a different approach to traditional or deploying lean in traditional manufacturing setting, but it's not radically. I think David and Dan can discuss it in more detail better than I.
We've talked a lot about labour there and about the people, and obviously, David, from a traditional lean point of view, it's very often about labour efficiency, yeah. Isn't it? But I think for dairy lean, it became clear early on that sort of we needed to expand our definition of labour or look at really what added the value. And as much as the labour, you know, does useful things, it's not necessarily the person on the farm that's adding the value, because the value is obviously milk leaving. So we had to look at it very much from the cow perspective, didn't we? Which is a different approach, perhaps.
I think that was the big light bulb moment a bit at the start of this, wasn't it? Is that, you know, the value here, when we define value in manufacturing, it's those processes that, you know, actually the things that people are paying for, the steps in the process, they're often transformative. So a piece of furniture, a saw cutting a piece of wood, that's a value step. And I think we normally see that with labour and machines in manufacturing. But actually, you know, I think one of the big moments for us was actually, you know, the value is the cow here. The cow is producing the milk. And at worst, you know, we're transporting that milk out of them and not adding more value to it. So I think one of the early things was, how do we, you know, define that value slightly differently, and how do we maximise value of the cow was kind of, I think, very early on, one of the big light bulb moments for us to say, well, how do we ensure that cow can create value as much as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So from a point of view, right, from your point of view, when this sort of lean management was mentioned, what were your first thoughts?
I'd heard about it sort of probably 10, 11 years ago. Did a master's in business management, and this guy came to speak to us one evening about lean. And I just sort of really bought into it at the time. And at the time I was working with in my parents' business, and I was the youngest one there. And a lot of staff have been there for a long time, and I tried to sort of implement things, and I didn't get anywhere because resistance to change is quite big. So I sort of packed it, and sort of I didn't forget about it, but like I didn't have the power or didn't know how to change that sort of situation at the time, and sort of, yeah, that was it. Then moved on, started farming and stuff, and I've heard it more recently of the last few years in sort of farming terms, and I didn't sort of know how it would work, because I just assumed it was for sort of manufacturing or production line type systems. So I didn't quite know, or couldn't quite see how we could benefit.
That's the context stuff, isn't it?
For you, that was sort of my I didn't understand at the time, I suppose, isn't it? So
neither did we at the start, if we're being really honest.
We thought we'd give it a go.
And that's one of the things that's been, like I say, it's been really interesting, is actually working on farms with David, for example, from the lean side, with Ben from the Leprino side, that comes into things that someone will say something in a different way and you'll be like, oh, hang on. Like we were talking about River Rocks theory the other day, just as an example of heifer pipelines and culling rates, is that the rocks in the rivers are obstacles, so you're... Some people fill the river higher so the rocks are hidden, when actually we just need to be removing the rocks.
Yeah.
And that's the same as having a high culling rate. Breeding a lot of replacements means you don't have to fix a problem that's there.
Yeah. Sticky tape was up
there. And you think, that's a principle that's existed in manufacturing for a long time. Right. It's directly applicable in what we're doing in terms of generating replacements. Mm. And you think, oh, that is exactly the same.
Yeah. So, how do you do that application? So what made you go, okay, yeah, no, now is the time to do it?
I suppose Ben.
I get the blame for a lot of things right now.
Yeah.
It's deserved, don't get me wrong.
I sort of, Ben spoke to us about it. You had a course going, and definitely why not, isn't it? I sort of, I like a bit of change, and if there's anything we can do to improve is to help, it's so I thought you always learn something, so just give it a go.
Absolutely. And we had a great one of the people we spoke to on the podcast was saying, you know, you can have a whinge about the milk price as much as you like, but unless actually you're prepared to put any effort into changing, how are you going to be able to continue to have a whinge about it? Because we would like to have a good whinge, but actually we can't just all whinge about the same thing all the time without us trying to take a step forward. And that's certainly what you're trying to do with the Lean program, I think.
He also pointed out once you'd taken that step forward, if the price was still crap and it made no difference, actually you're completely valid then in having that whinge because you've made the effort as well. So, you know, it's worth pointing that out.
Yeah. So in terms of the team, there's a team sat around this table, which is obviously a brilliant team. Who's played what role?
I suppose, so in terms of stupid idea, that was me. In terms of then sort of matching that sort of stupid idea, that grand ambition, basically I wanted a way of suggesting to farmers that you know, within your system, if you do this, this, and this, and this, you know, you could find an efficiency. And some of that came out of previous work, actually, I've undertaken with David and Neil in the pig industry. So we had a framework that we knew worked for pigs, and it was still quite labour-lent in sort of that industry. And we knew, actually, again, because Neil and David had undertaken an international lean review that showed sort of where lean worked, there was generally sort of a five-step process. So we've got this vague outline. David and Neil really sort of fleshed that out from a lean point of view. And then what we needed was that ability to translate it to dairy. And that's actually obviously where Dan's come in substantially. But then actually the farms themselves, because you have been guinea pigs. You know, there's no two ways about it. And we've run it here before, sort of looking to push it out broader in GB. And then also next year, we're looking to do another trial in Northern Ireland to make sure actually at a cultural level, it moves across, because we've talked about toolkits, but a lot of lean is about people engagement. You can't ignore the human beings that are doing the job day to day. It has to be applicable. There's a lot of soft skills that go with lean, you know, sort of management of human beings. So I think that would be my vision of it.
I suppose the role that we've been playing from a lean perspective is, you know, is bringing the principles and, you know, the application of facilitation on the days. When we're together, and the Lego,
and the Lego. Lego seems to be very important.
Yeah, so the Lego, obviously, we bring the Lego to be able to enable
and
people
more
to
post-it
play.
Notes than you can shake a stick out.
Yes, more post-it notes and paper than you can shake a stick out. But yeah, I think, you know, what's been good with having Dan and Ben involved in this is that we've been able to shape something that works for dairy more. Mm-hmm. I think, but still have the tools that sit behind it. So, you know, the hope being we're not just coming and applying a standard way of doing things for a farm that says if you do it like this, this is the best way of doing it. We're able to use the tools to come up with some best method and use the tools to help improve. So I think that's how we've worked together. It involved quite a lot in the first instance of getting some data to be able to do this value stream bit, to be able to understand the whole business, which took a while. But you know, the insights we got from actually trying to get some good information from the data. You know, farms are general impression. One of the things we were asked when we did the program with pigs is what was really good about it, and farms generally have loads more data than most businesses. That's one of the, so we generally go to business and they have no data about performance or anything. Unfortunately, that data is not very well transferred into information that people can actually use and make improvements on. So I think that's another thing we've found, actually, is that it's great because there's lots of data, that being put in a format and being able to be used in a way that's you know, farms can then go, I can see some improvements, I can see what I need to do. It's quite hard. So we've spent quite a bit of time, again, collectively working on that to help us to get to when we come and do an activity, we're not just coming and applying just some old tool just because that's the one we wanted to apply. It's based on we've identified this problem and therefore we can use these tools and techniques to attack it.
So Dan, how have you... That data thing has been a complete theme throughout the whole of these podcasts and you can't ignore it at all. No. So how have you been able to use the data differently through the lean process than you would have in traditional vetting?
That's a very good question, actually. Sometimes we can start looking at data and there's the whole thing about people assembling a load of KPIs, which are no longer KPIs, they're every performance indicator, that they suddenly have a dashboard of so many bells and whistles that you've got no idea what's going on.
Yep.
And there's so many situations when they aren't used to make an actual decision on when you can actually enact any change and things. So lots of the stuff we've done with data is, and it's been very useful actually, and I think very helpful, especially David coming back from not being involved with dairying particularly just before this, to be able to ask them, why do you do that? Why is this metric important? Why aren't you looking at some other things? That we have actually looked at some of the metrics from a completely new angle, which we're still building with people and trialing and testing on farm. But really trying to make sure we're drilling it down into genuinely useful key bits of information that will enable a change to happen in a timescale that will actually impact what we're doing, rather than it just be a retrospective. We're looking at lead measures, really, rather than so much dairy performance management is lag measures. This is how I did.
Yeah, without, this is the result.
This is our building it. Yeah. And then not having the thing of, like, what are we going to do about this at different stages on the way forward? One thing we've been doing with Reynard this morning is looking at historical fertility data, but we didn't dwell on that for very long at all. It was all about what are we going to do next year and what are the way markers and the data points you need. And then after we've done this, we're going to carry on and we're going to put some visual tools in place that mean we've separated decision making from action, mm-hmm. because trying to make your decisions while you're flat out is not a good way to do things. But Reynard and Rachel need that thing to be like, yes, we're on track, we're still on plan A, or just a simple thing, no, we're going down plan B because plan A hasn't worked. So actually looking at the key bits of data for the individual businesses, and a common thing we get all the way across dairying is there's just so many different forms of data, which is all extra processing, which is a waste. Yeah. Effectively, it's one of the eight wastes that you get in lean. That there's also so many different languages. There's so many different bits. Like, I'm sure you've got very frustrated because you've done a lot of data crunching and they've asked, can you get this data for this farm? No, because it's in a completely different format because this software doesn't do it. Yeah. But you can get it for this farm. Yeah. Or this farm, the metric, that KPI is calculated differently from this piece of software.
Yeah. And they just don't talk to each other.
Yeah, you can't get them together. Yeah. And you
lots of great data, not lots of great information is what we've come across. And I think, I've been in farms where we've been taking numbers off screens and stuff because you can't get it off the system, and it's that.
And it's opaque in how it's calculated.
Yeah, and you don't know where that number's, there's lots of issues with it, which is such a shame, as I say, for an industry that is data rich. If we'd had this data when I was doing manufacturing in other industries, would have been, so happy.
Yeah.
Because you just don't have it. You don't have it at this level of granularity. It's just such a shame it's not in a format that, as Dan describes, that it gives that real sort of dashboard for the business that says, what are the key things I need to look after, and then what's all the associated data that helps me get to the root cause of where I can get some improvements.
That's a good point, because it's presented in silos, isn't it? You'll often get a KPI, and if you do get that KPI, sometimes there's some good visualisation that gets with it, but it can then feed into that narrative of sort of an oversimplification. So I don't know how many times we've sort of heard, and particularly in a block carving, if your fertility's grand, your business is set. You're all right. Yeah. But actually, you can overperform on fertility. You can be awash with sort of, potentially great quality animals. And I did have a gentleman that sort of used a line that I will never forget because it sounded so true but couldn't be so wrong. And he said to me, a cow on the farm is cash in the bank. And I was like, I sort of see what you mean, because that animal has a value, but while it's on your farm, it's eating food, which is cash out your bank. It's taking up labour, which is cash out your bank. It's taking up veterinary medicine and bits and pieces, which is cash out of your bank.
And until it's had that first calf, it's milking.
Well, and absolutely. And, even down to the, if you're on rented ground, it's cash out your bank and various other bits and pieces. And absolutely, it can have a value. So I saw the logic he was going. But the value of a calf is a KPI.
Mm.
Actually, it sits quite often detached from all of that other information, which shows you that what you've said is just not true.
Mm.
And I think we miss that, and we're not very good at showing the lost opportunity cost, the what if. Mm. And that's been quite enlightening, sort of, when you start to talk about sort of, what if you didn't do that? What would you have back? Well, I've always done it. Yeah, I know you have, but if you didn't, what could you have back? And some of those values on some farms have been staggering. On others, it's actually, it's not. It's been at best marginal.
Yeah.
But, some of those are really, really large units. You're talking hundreds of thousands of pounds of...
That effort is worth that return.
Yeah.
But it's you know, I suppose the other thing, just to go back to the strength of that data, we have been able to calculate some of those numbers to help decision making, because nothing beats having a pounds number to say, actually, if I do this, it's going to cost me this and it will save me this.
Yeah,
as it has a huge, you know, and it has been relatively easy to get to those types of numbers based on benchmarks and based on the data that farms have. Again, I think it really helps the decision making.
And we've been very careful with those numbers. So I'm in conversations with Reynold, you know, you calculate sort of the cost of your heifer replacements and it's very low compared to a lot of others, given sort of what you do. Others have sort of talked about nearly £2,000 or in excess of £2,000 of heifer rearing costs. We've assumed £1,400 because it's nice and in the middle. We've assumed a long run milk price of 30p, which let's hope it doesn't ever hit that. But you know, that's we've assumed all of these bits and pieces, and you're talking just shy of £950,000 worth of year one savings across 10 businesses. And there's a huge range there from sort of just under 20k to just under £200,000. Yeah. And obviously, scale of businesses plays a huge role in that. So you could almost sort of, you know, per 100 cows sort of starts to look at returns. Mm-hmm. But that's without outlay. So when you start to talk about the money that if you invested 10k on, you know, some feed barriers or you know, a bit of parlor software or 20k on some RFID kit, there's an ROI figure that then comes in. Mm-hmm. And we're actually talking about millions of pounds and over 5 years, which, you know, you treat this as an investment, mm-hmm. investing in the consultancy time. Over those 5 years, you are talking millions of pounds coming into those businesses. That's 10 farms.
That's crazy.
Yeah, we've sort of 200 plus 220 farms in Wales alone, in GB. So you times that figure by those, again, or by an average, somewhere in the middle or even below, you're talking millions of pounds.
Yep.
That's only 20% of the milk in Wales. Yep. And you know, you start to see that if we support farmers in efficiency, actually for our business as a processor, a strong supply base provides a lower risk sort of trading environment. Mm-hmm. And actually for us to make that investment is absolutely a really sound investment to make.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is other people to realise that as well, because, you know, I think accessing this advice on an individual farm level can be a bit more challenging.
Yeah. Oh, it can. It's how do you get it to the masses, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's absolutely that.
It strikes me as being a significant amount of lost opportunity cost here, and we could recover that from the farm business, surely?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I know we had a small trial, but within that sort of group of 10 farmers, there was a range of between 3 and just over 6 pence per litre of recoverable costs across those farms. In terms of the word efficiency, let's start with the word efficiency. Is efficiency the right word to use? Is it a nice word? Is it a good word?
I think, like, I've been thinking a lot about this, Ben, because I want to do another podcast and I want to do it about efficiency.
Okay.
And I think lean, we're going to come to that. Lean is the central to that.
Mm.
But I think the wider thing is efficiency and our, as farmers, our relationship with efficiency. And you hear it all the time from consultants, you've got to be more efficient, but you do hear it from farmers. You hear it from farmers saying, how much more efficient can we be? And with the insinuation that they can't be more efficient. And it's absolutely, it's a prime example of not knowing what you don't know what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I tell you, there's an absolute other world beyond this for farmers. And I know maybe farmers listening to this will be getting upset already about this, but let's self-reflect on that. Why are we getting upset about the word efficiency? And I think in many ways you've got and I heard Paul Akers, who's a big lean guy, isn't he?
Yes.
A sort of guru.
2 second lean.
Yeah. And he said lean management, or in many ways efficiency, is about looking inside yourself, looking at your faults, looking at your you know, your weaknesses,
mm.
and accepting them. It's not so. It's like being a coach to yourself, really. It's not doing yourself down or anything like that. It's a positive thing. Seeing your faults, seeing your weaknesses, and addressing them aggressively. So actually turning that around. And going for it and saying, right, this is it. If spending less time on more stuff is efficient, and that you cannot argue that that's a good idea. Mm. And I think efficiency is a mental thing. I think we don't want to, you see it all the time in people in their patterns, that they don't want to, you know, oh, what am I like? That's just me. You know, that sort of thing. And yeah, we're absolutely set in stone with, but we don't need to be. And I am the most chaotic, people will be laughing at this with efficiency, but I am the most chaotic, disorganized farmer in some ways. I think I choose the right things to do, but I don't really perform them very well. So because I'm chaotic and disorganized. So I've been down with you, Ben, looking at farms. We went to Reynolds Farm and with all the lean guru guys. And I've been speaking to Neil and David and Carla about lean and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know. I'm very aware of a voice inside my head. Now, don't call the yellow van or anything, but but there's a voice inside my head resisting.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. I don't know why it's resisting, but I don't want to be efficient. If I'm listening to that, if I really take that voice seriously, I won't be, and I don't want to be efficient. And, yeah, I suppose it's a very emotive word. I know someone that gets very upset with me using efficient and wants to be effective, not efficient. But this is just semantics.
I was going to say, we're starting to talk semantics now.
Negativity with efficiency, though? What's the negativity with that word? Why effective, not efficient, or vice versa? What's the problem with efficiency?
I wonder if it's external, it has associations with external people that don't understand.
Yeah,
I think it's maybe the ship mechanics, Ben. I don't know, but I think that's partly it.
So a lot of this comes down to how it makes you feel, essentially. Yeah. How does all of this make you as Michael or Ben or Helen, how does all that person who likes effective rather than efficient or whatever it was, how does actually all of this make you feel? And I think there was somebody else we'd spoken to as part of this podcast when we mentioned efficient, and they said a lot of people think that efficient is doing more with less to be efficient. And actually, that's quite an extreme vision of efficient. Actually, should we just be thinking about how can we do more with the same? Like, how can we get more out of what we're already doing? And maybe that comes down to your little bit of chaos in the way that, okay, I've got 10 things to do today. And if I really thought about how to do them effectively, efficiently, whatever that word is, I do them A, B, C, D, E, F, G, blah, 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 blah. But because of the different stimuli you get and the way you feel about these different things, because some things are hard and some things are not so hard and some things you like to do and some things you don't like to do. And so that creates an A, H, B, J, Z. Do you know? But that's because we're human. That's what creates that.
You're suggesting that we are efficiency dyslexics.
I probably am, yeah.
That's our natural state as human beings.
efficiently dyslexic, absolutely. But it is, it's how we feel. I think that has a huge amount to it as well.
It's very easy, I think. I mean, you mentioned, Michael, there some lean gurus, and there are plenty of them about, and sometimes they sort of drive Corvettes and they have an American accent. Other times they don't. But I think there's the lean gurus and there's the lean cultists, and some of those lean cultists will tell you it's the greatest thing in the world and it will save the universe in bits and pieces. But I think we should acknowledge that there are lots of management structures out there. All of them, if not used right, will fail. And a lot of them will fail a lot of the times because they fail to acknowledge the humanity. You can't just look at a business as a set of, you know, interconnected processes in a purely abstract way. There's a human being that's driving sort of the motion through that. And I think if you fail to acknowledge the person, you've failed to actually achieve anything.
Yeah, maybe it is about acknowledgement.
Mm.
You know, going back to the what we're, yeah. I don't know. I'm fascinated by the lean cultists, though.
Lean cultists. These are these happy young people. I'm sort of paraphrasing David Crowfoot here now, and I hope David is listening to this, because I'm going to try and mimic David's frustration.
Here we go.
He went, you get these young people who've discovered lean. They think it's the greatest thing in the world, and the world's not ground them down yet. They're too happy about lean, and let's face it, a lot of it's bollocks. He was brilliant. He was absolutely brilliant.
I've been sharing a couple of things, and I think David, his silence has been probably illustrative of his attitude to, because I interviewed Paul Akers, you see. Paul Akers said yes.
Did you?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's on Patreon.
You move with all the greats, Michael.
We're deeply honored
to be in your presence.
But he said yes. It's amazing that he said yes, really. Paul's on the sort of not the cultist side, but you can see why he's so enthusiastic. I'd just like to do, you know, a Louis through sort of, I was spending time with Paul Akers. That sort of thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So maybe Ben then needs to be less lean evangelism and more practical experience to convince the farmers of its relevance to them and to their farms. And Renault is one of those who has that practical farm experience and has been delivering it on farm for farmers.
Yeah, so we can hear from Reynald about what this has delivered from his experience.
But Reynald, so coming back to yourselves and Rachel and the farm, what has this meant to you from a day-to-day point of view and from a looking forward point of view?
Having to put up with us turning up and eat all your cake.
Day-to-day, on your initial visit, we looked at milking routine and the practicalities around that and streamlining that. So it almost instantly we saw sort of 10, 15 minutes taken off milking time. So that twice a day, 7 days a week, it's a lot of time, isn't it? Electricity. So that was sort of an immediate hit. We've looked at fertility and synchronising heifers or different options. So hopefully, you know, there's long-term stuff as well, benefits to come. So, it's been quite positive, really.
Time.
Yeah.
But then very quietly you went, well, that saves electricity.
Mm.
And it's like, yeah, we've spoken about this quite a few of the podcasts. Yeah, it saves time, but it might save fuel, or it might save electricity, or it might save water, or, you know, all of those sort of consumable things that then start to build up around it.
The other thing that's really important with the saving of milking time, that's the times cows aren't, you know, doing what they're doing in terms of value while they're being milked. So if we can take time off milking, that means there's potentially more time they're lying down, they're eating, really they're drinking, et cetera, et cetera, which is... means that, you know, potentially produce more milk, which is better. So I think traditionally, from a lean perspective, we'd look at the labour and go, yes, we've saved labour. Yeah. But actually, there's a bigger gain in dairy. It's about every time you can, take time out of something like milking.
It's one of the things, before the lean thing, I've always enjoyed talking to farmers about things like the cow day and considering the cows as the employees on the farm, as the labour, because it is their job to convert raw material into milk. Yeah. Everyone else is a supervisor of those cows.
At best.
And I often liken it to a factory situation when you're discussing with farmers, that say you've got your cows, it's their job to turn the feed into milk. They do it 40% faster if they're lying down or sitting in comfortable chairs. What do you buy them as a factory owner? All the comfy chairs you can get. Yeah. And enough of them. Like, I don't want you standing up working when you do. Yeah, quite. Absolutely. Then we do things on farms, admittedly, with a lack of understanding potentially of things where we restrict their access to the raw materials. So you're paying them to convert X into milk, and then you make the feed barrier so difficult that they can't access it. And when you liken it to these are the employees here, people are like, yeah, that's absolutely madness. And you can do it hilariously in farmer discussion groups, and I like this one, is you have a farmer discussion group, you don't put enough chairs in the room, and you watch farmers go in, and it's hilarious because you will get them acting just like cows.
Yeah.
You will get the ones that dominate and sort of try to push ones out, like, I want to see.
Out.
You'll find some farmers that sort of spot it and stand just at the side of the room
and stuff. And so you see that kind of thing. Yeah. And like sometimes one of the real benefits of this whole project has been able to use these opportunities to visualize these things, to translate it into something that's a different context that removes it, to then bring it back into Daring has been really good. One of the bits I think that's, we talked about all those savings, that all started from conversations with each of those businesses of like, where have you defined the value and what is the value in this business? What are your goals? What are you, there's sometimes refinement of goals, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, in terms of that, and therefore what resource do we actually need to efficiently meet these goals, rather than, people often have a literage target, but have excess cattle underperforming to hit that literage target, yeah, when actually you can pull that down and do it in much less or much lower replacement rates, mm, or something like that. Mm. So defining the value and then looking for where we can eliminate the waste has been is key. And so Reynolds has got a good example. We looked at milking to start with. How do we, where's the value in this? Getting cows through, getting the same amount of milk on them, let's do that. Then let's look at the wastes. But then we can move on to some really more of the longer term things. Lean isn't just a one task thing, it's a full business system. So when we're talking about fertility, we're actually talking about everything that Rachel and Reynolds are going to be doing in May next year.
Yeah.
But planning that, so it will be a little bit longer till we see those things, but they're long and impactful, yeah, changes.
The course has been fairly long as well, and actually that's, it's worth crediting Raynor and Rachel A for how much cake we've eaten over what is, what will run almost a year.
I don't think they need to be and 2 kilos of butter.
You're the cow in this, David. Yes, it's basically what we're saying.
That would be the first or the last.
But actually, I mean, it's a long time commitment, and there will be lean courses, and you do see sort of we had a talk about sort of 2 second leans and 10 second lean videos, which are incredibly interesting and valuable in bits and pieces. But actually, lean from an agricultural point of view, and actually education, full stop. I think not even just from an agricultural point of view, is often very transactional. And the whole point of lean is it's looking at the relationship between the cow and the people and the staff and the system. And you can't do that in a transactional manner. You can't turn up, do a day's course and go, right, I fixed you, we're off. Yeah. You know, the point here was, and don't get me wrong, the plan is not to walk away next year. You know, we don't know really sort of how to take this further. There'll still be further guinea pigging next year, I think. But the aim is to get to a point where sort of we do walk away from farms or sort of move back from farms and sort of try and scale this and still bring them with us. That it wasn't Dan and David turning up, certainly it wasn't me, but it wasn't Dan and David turning up that sort of made the difference or it's entirely relying on them. Mm-hmm. It's about sort of, you know, providing the farm and the system with the sort of the tools to and you know, the confidence to go and do it. And for me, it felt that couldn't be done transactionally. So, you know, there are 5 sessions over what will be essentially 12 months. You know, we'll finish sort of February next year with a bit of a roundup summary session, almost a handover to the next generation. So the plan is to probably to head to Northern Ireland and look at sort of, you know, doing a bit of a sort of farmer experience, sharing sort of with the old guard and the new, so to speak. But that's quite a commitment from the farms. I mean, that's not to be underestimated, actually, in sort of, you know, because that's what would be nearly 6-7 days off farm in total, which sometimes that's probably nice. I think it's Rachel's turn next, isn't it?
Yeah,
she's ready, so she's coming to dinner later.
I was going to say, like, if Ben puts his fingers in his ears, like Ben's obviously worked very hard in terms of understanding the change process that's required, and we've had long chats on behavioural traits, reset models, all those things that actually enable change to happen, yeah. But really understanding what the ingredients for change were before implementing these kind of things was important in the way that it's actually then been delivered. Because so many things just turn up and smack someone with some information and then don't follow it.
Yeah.
Don't, like, or expect a decision that's then not considered at that point.
And has this caused a shift in how we deliver education?
Absolutely, it has for us. I mean, as Dan mentioned, we recognised that we needed a different approach, not only in what was delivered, but by who and how. I mean, this was informed by a chunk of work undertaken at AHDB on how farmers prefer to learn, informed by the farmers themselves.
But I think one of the points here, Ben, is have we always actually found the right people to deliver the education or the support or the advice to the variety of audiences we deal with?
No, not always. And I suppose we come back to the risk of finding those happy lean evangelists or the grumpy stuck in their ways consultants and having them turning up on farm and the consequence.
Talking about, Ben, what you were saying about happy people, and maybe we don't put them into an age bracket because these people exist all through life, but those happy people that understand lean, do they understand people?
No, so this is one, and Michael's met some of our lean gurus, and I'll be honest with you, I've met quite a few people who are incredibly talented at sort of finding efficiency and delivering efficiency within various settings, quite often manufacturing settings. Having engaged with agriculturalists across various sectors and bits and pieces, I realised that some of those human beings don't necessarily translate well into an agricultural setting. I mean, I have literally seen a lean person walk through a pig farm, as it was, and tell them the secret to success here is feed them less and turn the lights off and ideally stop them dying, which you can imagine when you've been up against it since 4 a.m, dealing with weaning and various other bits and pieces in the down sideways sort of December rain.
Yeah.
When somebody has the gall to say that to you in your own pig shed, you're tempted to kill them and feed them to said pigs.
Absolutely. You know,
that doesn't help. So finding the right people and telling the right story of lean, not ignoring the humanity of it, because I think actually, Michael, the eureka moment is effectiveness, efficiency, and time are interconnected, and that connection is a human being, and it's our perception of both. And if you can align the perception of those into a harmonious stream, and maybe other frameworks are available, lean is the thing that can do that for some people, that's the coming together, and maybe that's the role that lean pulls. But you cannot ignore humanity, just can't do it. It won't work.
No, I get you, but then that's, yeah, okay. I accept your theory on that.
No, it's very nice of you. Thank you. Yeah. That was easier than I thought. I thought I was going to throw something out there.
No, isn't it interesting? I think there's a difference between the person, because I'm talking about, you know, we're all small to medium businesses, aren't we? I'm on my own.
It's a farming point of view, yeah.
So I just do the farm on my own. I do work very closely with a neighbour, actually, but it's 1, 2, 3 people, really. And it's the imposition of lean that would be a problem. What I was told is that you have to do it yourself. It's a pull, not a push. And you have to do it yourself. You have to make little improvements day by day, just little improvements. And that's the way you do it. And you've got to decide within yourself that actually I'm not quite happy with the way I'm working. And it's not because I'm not quite happy with my patterns of working. And it's not because of my personality. I've done a personality test. That means I'm locked in this little box of my personality. That is not
true. You've got a certificate.
No, exactly. That is not true. In fact, I'm at that conference we were at, after you walked out, Ben. But we had a really good discussion, and people kept coming up with, I am X, Y, and Z. You know, the
Myers-Briggs.
That's me. So this is, I suppose this is it. But that's not the case. You can make little changes all the time to get to where you would be happier. And the first is to acknowledge that actually, and I'm sounding a little bit evangelical about it, because I'm finally realizing that I've always been happy with myself, really. But I think there's certain things that bug me a little bit about how I work. And actually, if I was honest, they bug me a lot. So I spend looking for stuff, waiting on stuff, you know, it's just not good enough. And I've got to accept that. And I've got a chance to make that better.
Yeah.
And it's not a personality thing. It's just a little bit more discipline. And actually, the discipline doesn't come that difficult if you just do it bit by tiny bit. And it's a habit. isn't it?
Yeah, and habits are a great, great thing, because habits really form some of the basis of why we do things. And actually, yeah, sometimes when we ask why several times, you just go, because. Because. And like you say, it's that moment of almost self-reflection and going, okay, well, does because bug me? Or am I happy in myself that, yeah, because is right, because it is habit, because it is some ingrained neuro pathway that I have created for myself, and it's going to take effort to turn that around.
Yes.
And what I really liked what you said a little while ago, Michael, was about, you know, when you're in consultancy mode and doing these sort of business plans for your clients, you know, you work on that vision and you work on that mission. And actually, it's just as important from my point of view to have a vision and a mission for yourself. This isn't about having a sales pitch or anything like that, what Helen is. But I need to have a vision and a mission. I need to know not necessarily where I'm going in 5 years' time, but what is my opportunity? And it's exactly the same for a business as for a person, to actually say, yes, okay, where am I going today? It doesn't have to be in 5 years' time. It can even be today. And am I just able to take that 10 seconds, 30 seconds to say, okay, reset. Is this the first thing I need to do? Does this make today good?
Yes.
And those tiny habits do creep in. And, you know, Tiny Habits is a name of a great book that I'd recommend to anybody to read. But it's that type of thing, of those small steps that create those change over time. But it's not a today or tomorrow. It is a months type of process, yeah, isn't it?
But you, in that situation, Helen, it was interesting. You talked about sort of making this day good, or making you happy, or bits and pieces. You'd assigned a value to that. I mean, lean is about sort of achieving value. And I think, I mean, it's a more weird word to say than efficiency and effectiveness. If you sort of look at something and go, shall we define the value of your business? It does feel like I've tie-dyed my own clothes and I've contrary to apparently have dreadlocks or something. I don't know. I smell of patchouli. Not that there's anything wrong with patchouli, but you know what I mean. It does feel a little bit odd, but that lean piece is all about value. And I think the most powerful tool we had, or we deployed, and I think this is important about lean, and it's another reason why it doesn't always work, is a lot of people think of it as a toolkit. It's not. It's a process strung together in the right order that allows you to move somebody from a realization of maybe they're uncomfortable and figuring out the exact lever, the point in their business where they're just uncomfortable enough to change, and then leading them through the process. So we use something called value stream mapping, which again is a very sort of technical tool, and it's a little bit scary, you know, because it's a thing that I have to do, and somebody's going to have to teach me this and blah, 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 blah. But really what it was, we literally wrote down all the jobs you do to produce milk. And then we went back over all of those and we showed out the connection. So what is the measure that comes out of there that makes sure that the start of that point is right? Yep. And we got them to write down their actual performance. And you realize sort of where the connections weren't right. Where were they uncomfortable enough to go, come on, you know, and I know that you're not happy with that.
Yeah.
And that was the in. And from there, Michael, as you pointed out, that's where the marginal gain started. But I think sometimes within agriculture, and I do see this, I sat down with a fella, and he sat down with me and he said, I listened to your talk about efficiency. And he said, it's made me uncomfortable. I said, oh, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to upset you, sort of thing. He said, no. He said, I realized maybe I need to change. I went, right, okay. He said, I've got 1,800 cows. you've done well. I don't know if you do, son. You know, I say that. He was considerably older than me. He was in his 70s. He said, yeah, I've got 18 over a couple of sites and blah, 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 blah. He said, I've got 2,000 young stock. And I just went, why? And obviously there was this whole conversation of various other bits and pieces, but the business was profitable. He'd got a labour pool. He was able to manage the things in the situation that he'd got there. And actually, you know, he had every right to turn around and go, why should I change? Because over the vast majority of his business, maybe also his body, but certainly over his business, he was just comfortable enough. He was comfortable enough that, you know, I'm making enough money. It's enough. But actually, there must have been that one process, that one thing. Why did he have to mention that number of lives, young stock, to me? Why was it bothering him? There was obviously something that was making him just uncomfortable enough that it was nagging away at him. And I think once we talked about that and we started to break it down in various other bits and pieces, you realise that's quite an expensive hobby to have, that sort of keeping of young stock and various other bits and bobs. And, you know, and we started to dig down a bit and whatnot. But maybe that's it. Maybe some of our business, particularly our profitable farming businesses, they are just comfortable enough.
That's kind of links back to what Helen was saying about vision, you know. Is it Jana Hocken?
You
all are involved in that, the lean...
She is, yeah.
She's the lean management dairy farmer from New Zealand. And she was doing a thing last night, which I attended. And she asked the question, which really made me think, is what does perfect look like in your farm? And that, again, is not a push. It's a pull. Mm. It's really important differential. What does perfect look like? And, I mean, you'll never get there. I know you'll never get there, but you've got to think about that. And then, and it's like a vision. A vision also is a pull. And I think that's powerful, not a push.
Now, you were saying that sort of, you know, some of these courses are brilliant and there's lots of courses we go on, but you sort of, you do that and you leave the course and you think, brilliant, I feel a bit G'd up and excited and bits and pieces, and you wake up the next morning and you're scraping the same shit. And I think the point of this, and I don't think we've cracked it yet, probably, but the point of this was that sort of we went through this year and you got to the end of it and it might quite literally be the same shit you're scraping, but it might not be the same way you're scraping it, or maybe you're not scraping it anymore because actually you can see and identify the value of doing this, that, or the other. And that was the plan of...
You're not doing it anymore because you've got a dairy.
Well, I mean, we laugh and we joke, but there was a very real reason for doing the value stream mapping first, and we saw this in the pig sector. We haven't seen this, touch wood, here. But there were those in the pig sector at the time. It was going through a very difficult time. We had that conversation. And actually, there are some of those businesses that, having done the work and have pushed the efficiency in bits and pieces, they have left. But it was an incredibly informed piece. They knew from the start. They had the data. And don't get me wrong, the market decided, really. But they did that with good, clear conscience, and they've gone.
Yeah.
And it's horrible and it's sad. And you've got to look at all the damage to the local area and the culture and various other bits and pieces. But actually, from that business point of view, it was the right decision, borne out in evidence and trial and effort and research. And that's it. And yeah, I'm very glad that we're all still going. So, but yeah, sometimes that's the answer. It's the inescapable answer. And we've even seen it. I mean, we go to the pigs again. You know, there were sort of blockages and barriers and problems that showed up in the bits and pieces. And sometimes it was a human being. And sometimes the best thing that human being could do was perhaps find an alternative career. Yeah. You know, I have worked in agricultural institutions in the past where conversations were had and various other bits and pieces. People weren't on board and they were moved.
Mm. And sometimes it's the best thing to do.
It was. It was a good business decision. And dare I say it, you could literally see sort of what was walking out the door and while that person was still there. You know, and it was money. Mm. So... it helped.
I'll be down the job centre tomorrow then.
I noticed how Rachel was looking at you during that.
Oh, funny. So in terms of probably, I mean, maybe top three things you've got out of the process so far, because the process hasn't finished. And I'm thinking on farm, but we've talked a lot about people, so maybe from more of a social side of things, what have you learned? And especially, I think we've talked about tools, we've talked about support, we've talked about confidence, all of those types of things that are really key. But what are those sort of three key things you've found benefits? And let's make sure we have one thing that you've gone about, because it can't all be positive.
Yeah, good question. Like directly then, like I mentioned, sort of the savings in time, also perhaps a bit of perspective as well on importance of time away from the farm or family time rather than just be
work.
Stuck behind the cows. yeah, and perhaps the stuff like I mentioned I didn't probably understand at the start. It's easy to say, oh, this can't be applicable to agri or dairying, but when you sit down and think about it or see some examples, actually, well, a lot of it is or can be applied. So. Mm-hmm. Those I think would be the three things of most value to ourselves. Yeah,
anything that's really grinded on you,
or if we could do it again. Yeah, me obviously, but if you could do it again, would there be something that we should have done more of, maybe, or less of?
I don't know how easy this would be, like if you had a bit more understanding about it before that first session, but I don't know, can you send someone some literature? Is that practical, or would people perhaps not read it? Or I don't know.
I think you would read it. There is a question over who would. There is something actually about sort of learning and stuff like that, because obviously we've asked you to come straight out and get stuck into it. There was a piece of research I did at AHDB that suggested people want to know the story before they have to come out and, like you said, jump into that first session. I probably ignored the research that we did. You make a good point. I think the challenge was we didn't have the story beforehand. Now we sort of do. Maybe we could do for the future, yeah.
Because that first session up in Anglesey, and, you know, about an hour in, going, like, moving from your chair and going to play with Lego, you're like, going, you didn't, you know.
It's not the first time we've heard this Lego, but what?
Yeah, but it is extremely powerful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, you just put on a fly, just a picture of some Lego bricks.
Yeah.
We'd be there.
The honest thing is that at that first meeting was when that was your big light bulb moment.
Yeah, it was the first, well, you were talking about, yeah, so that was the first light bulb moment.
You liked it there when Michael mentioned about the pull.
I did. It's a very lean term, but I think it highlights our challenge in agriculture in that we don't pull or allow a natural pull of sort of processes or inputs through a process. Instead, we try and push them through. And it's wearing to do, I think, as a farmer, pushing resources into a potentially inefficient system.
Yeah, it can be hard work. But how do you think undertaking lean and the lean process can help farmers feel more efficient in their production?
Because if you send someone a load of literature, would they read it beforehand?
Perhaps
you'd have to go through that process.
Or just some handy podcast, really, that sort of gives them an overview.
A little video snippet.
Ideal, perhaps, yeah.
I think there's definitely something interesting in that, isn't there? Yeah. I think there's the Lego simulation in every business and every sector is always really powerful. And there's an element of people get it if they do the Lego. But I think it's getting people to the Lego that's the hard
that's
bit,
the challenge.
I think.
Yeah.
That's the challenge. So, yeah. I think if you sent people the principles, the wastes and stuff, and even if we, you know, we've made them more dairy applicable now, I still think it's a bit, it just doesn't capture. So I think, you know, hopefully we'll have some stories to say about what we've done and what we've improved.
There are plenty of people that wouldn't have turned up.
That's the point I was trying to make. But as I said, like, people wouldn't turn up, perhaps.
But I think
there were a few that didn't. You know, if we've been really honest, there were one or two that sort of never made it to the first session. We've lost one since the first session, for different reasons, to be fair. But yeah, it's a very valid point.
But we need to make people curious to...
It's that story, I think. I think that's a really good point, isn't it? The story.
It's the story, and then, as you've said at the beginning, going back to that reset, is the social pressure, social ambassadors that actually, hopefully through this process, we've created some farms who get it, have been on a journey, that it isn't the salesman as in us selling it, it's people that are advocating it because it's been really good for their business.
Yeah. And there is an attempt in a sort of vaguely Machiavellian way of mine to sort of, is to build that reset piece. I mean, you know, the economics of this are the return on investments that the farms have seen, the social ambassadors are very much the farms themselves. You know, there's no accident. I've sort of suggested maybe go to Northern Ireland and we do some stuff with some Northern Irish farmers that might come on the journey. You know, there is more education. It's not just the actual lean training, it's education, but everything that comes with it. And then I suppose the lean's the thing. I mean, from a regulation point of view, I don't think we need to set that. The world is a changing. Milk prices are where they are. You know, they're not. I wouldn't call them favourable necessarily.
Regulation might look a little bit different to what we anticipate as well. It might be NBZs. Yeah. It might be carbon. It might be something like that that's going to have a productivity impact.
I think there's so much of it. You know,
rather than a lean piece.
Yeah, Leprino don't need to set it. Basically, the world is
the process
hard enough.
The process then drives that social element. Yeah. Which can be the real sticking point.
And there was an element under the regulation that we insisted that there was a particular methodology to here. I mean, the law was you will follow lean as we've sort of pulled it out. You know,
that is the best practice.
Maybe it wasn't regulation, but rigour that we put in place that was there.
Well, we're trying to learn, aren't we? I think that's the important thing from us. You know, we're trying to learn how this stuff is applied.
I've said rigour. I don't know how rigorous this was, but
rigour. I'm just trying to back that off now. So the rigour,
Can you see raised eyebrows on a podcast?
Yes, but yeah, so I think
you can feel them.
you know, making sure we learn from this experience so we can apply it and have the stories, the all of that important stuff for next time around. Yeah. But this, you know, as you say, we a few moments ago we said we're flying by our pants as well, so I think somewhere in the middle.
That's the cycle, isn't it? About bringing that round to the cycle. It's not a linear process. There are elements of cycled
and being
constant improvement.
Yes.
We'll talk about reset and levers for supporting change in episode 5 and actually episode 6 as well. But it sounds like there's now a toolkit coming out of this programme to support finding efficiencies on farm and driving real business change.
Yeah, we're getting there. I mean, obviously, when we talk to Michael, I think we'll see more of something that you and I discuss a lot, which is understanding our audience. And it's something we still need to understand more because not all farms are the same.
Sure. Yeah. I think one of the things we've sort of skirted round, because really importantly, and I really like the fact that we've been talking about the humanity and the people and the feeling and the push versus the pull, but we haven't really specifically spoken about the link between time and money. We've skirted around it quite a lot. And actually one of the famous phrases is time is money. But actually, from your point of view, Michael, does that ring true?
Yes, Helen, it does ring true. Interestingly, it's not the first thing I think about. Why is that? Gosh. But I think, I don't know. You've almost got to build it. And they will come because I do consultancy. I think that's a difference also. If you're a full-time farmer, you do employ Parkinson's law in that you've got a certain amount of time. You just fill that time available with the job. But I've got enough consultancy. I'm not looking for any more. But if I had loads of time, I would. And then, so it's not instantly more money if I had more time. There's something to build there and then I get more money. But you're dead right. A whole thing about this is that I am a first generation farmer that started with very little negative amounts, and I need to get to a point where I have a lump sum where I can take on my retirement, you know, not just spend it on a cardboard box so I can live in that. I need a house and I need to build a capital asset. Mm. So I need all this time to be really pinpoint accurate. Every second counts, you know, and so that's a roundabout way of saying, yes, Helen, you're right.
It is. And I hear what you're saying. However, now you've just put in a great example. So, the equation could be time equals money. Job done. Equation sorted. But what you then brought into the conversation is time equals steps towards money.
Yes.
And that's, I think that's. Yeah. And that's the important bit. It's just that having more time does not equal more money. But the utilization of time and, you know, freeing up time or whatever you need to do with time for your reason is then leads to the steps that can create more income, money, profit, call it what we will. If we take Ben's example of the 1800 cow farmer, you know, profitable. However, you know, could more time equal more profit? Money wasn't his driver potentially. Actually, that niggle of the value that gave to him and to his business potentially was.
I think, that is, and you've touched on something there. There's got to be a faith. There's got to be a faith in that if you change practice, you've got to have the faith that actually that will lead to something good. Be it time, more money, you've got to have a faith in that. And I think that's, we lack faith that changes of that nature will actually, produce something better.
It ties into a world famous Blanche catchphrase now, which is it's about doing the right thing rather than doing things right, because it's those things that you are, the steps are the things to get to more money, and so they've got to be the right thing in the first place.
Yes, you've got yeah, you've got, well, isn't your catchphrase, you've got to have your ladder on the right wall.
That makes me sound like a peeping Tom, but I mean, no in so in many ways, Michael, absolutely, yes, you do. My catchphrase in life is never sniff it first. That's my personal catchphrase.
Never sniff it what?
Never sniff it first.
Right. Okay. We could do another podcast about that.
That is a whole podcast series that has many connotations. In fact, just as a title, never sniff it first.
I'm looking forward to me singing the theme tune.
That is a theme tune I would love. Yeah, okay. All seriousness now, obviously we're trying to solve all of the world's problems. So I mean, we've talked around, and it could sound very much to the casual listener that Helen and I are trying to bully you into saying that lean is the best thing in the world. But in true honesty, be it lean or being anything else, how sold are you on this concept of there are skill sets or toolkits or various other bits and pieces we can use to be better? Do you think we can?
Right, I'm trying not to sound like a lean maniac, like a cultist.
A cultist. No, I'm not one of those.
Absolutely. No, I tell you, and I suppose because I'm a first generation farmer and I've always wanted to farm, and now I do farm, I'm so grateful for where we are and what we do. But I do see it, I don't see the next generation. This is my dream. So it's just, this is, you know, the next generation aren't going to farm, I don't think. But it's my journey to farming enlightenment that interests me. And I just want to end as being as best as I possibly can be, you know, and honestly, it's starting from a very low base. So it's,
you know, is up.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the best players don't make good coaches, eh? But, So you know, I'm a flawed individual, but I'm absolutely so interested in how I can be the best farmer I can be. Mm. And I think I'm so excited about lean. I started, the first real engagement I had with it was on the Time podcast, It's About Time.
Yeah.
And it was with Neil Fedden.
And his Five Types of Black Pudding.
Yeah. And
it's a whole story there, Helen, sorry.
Yeah, Andrew Palmer, and
good old AP.
Good old AP.
We all call him AP.
Oh, AP, sorry.
For sure.
Anyway, yeah. that sort of just had a little bit of interest there, and that has started to grow and grow and grow and become really. I've read 2 Second Lean. I'm on the Toyota Way, which is really dense.
Not like reading.
I've listened to lots and lots of podcasts on lean, and although as a chaotic, disorganized person, I have a suspicion that it's a sort of cover for some sort of OCD, but I think that's how I can get far, far better as a farmer. And that's my weakness. I've looked inside myself. That is my weakness. I'm good at other things. I'm good at other things than the farm. But my weakness, the thing that is really holding me back, is process management, knowing where everything is, waste, absolute huge amounts of waste on this farm. And I need to address it aggressively.
Yeah. So some of that does come down to personal image. So what is your personal image? Is your personal image of a good farmer who is not wasteful and has extra time to do X, Y, and Z? And that again comes back to what we were talking before, that the personal image I have now of myself, that at the moment what you're saying, Michael, is actually you perceive yourself to be a little bit chaotic and a little bit disorganized and all of that type of thing. That personal image can change. But it's owning it, and it's acknowledging it, and acknowledging that you want that to change. You know, there are parts of your self-image that please don't change because you're fantastic. And, you know, but there are parts of your image that you are saying, yeah, I want to change. And that's about ownership.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is something still nagging at me is, you know, weirdly, my mum has on her bathroom, tidy women. Oh, no, what was it? I can't remember exactly what it is. Tidy women are dull.
Yes.
Something like that. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe it will.
It's an odd insult to sling out at people, though, isn't it? It's not something you hear shouted out of cars as you drive past.
You tidy women are dull. But yeah, no, it's just that I think there's a way of maintaining my personality, but yeah, actually becoming really effective and efficient. And that's going back to the vision, that Jana Hocken said, what did she say? Your burning platform, you know, what are the three things that you really want and that really motivate you? And I want to be the best farmer I could possibly be. I've got one shot. I've started from nothing. I want to absolutely get to as far up the mountain as possible. And I need something like lean. And it's been 80 years in the making. It's real. I love my Toyota Hilux. And it's built really well. That's even I can't kill it. That is and Toyota are the main people that came up with lean. So, you know, I think that's, if I'm serious about wanting to be the best farmer I can be, I've got to look inside myself and actually be positive but constructive and say, you've got to change.
Michael's mentioned about a burning platform that's driving a need for his continuous improvement and hopefully, you know, everyone's continuous improvement within them. Have we managed to get from this the burning platform that demands change to a story and how to actually do it yet?
I think, as we'll discuss with Reynald, the answer's probably not quite yet.
Being honest, actually the constant improvement piece, there's no hint of irony of mentioning that here. The bit we haven't really got then, and we still need to work on, is that story. We don't quite know how we'll do this, because if I turn around in front of a group of farmers and say, I work with 10 farms and we save, you know, just shy of £1 million, they'll go, all right, big time. Of course you did.
Well done.
But actually translating that and making it relevant and various other bits and pieces, because, I mean, you think, Reynold, on the actual cause of those 10 farmers, the range of differences, isn't there, from genetics to herd size to... Yeah.
But that's where you've got all your hooks, because you've got so many different farmers focusing on so many different things that actually it's enabling them to tell their own story as well as the process.
And often there's a commonality. I mean, you must have found with a few on there, their systems are poles apart from you, but there must have been bits and pieces you had that are very common, or bits you saw that they were doing that you thought, oh, I wonder if that would work for me.
Yeah, well, definitely. And sort of, as you, Paul Lorenz on farming system, but there's always stuff we perhaps you can learn, like from the Highlanders and, you know, cow welfare, husbandry or dietary or transitions, even like on a spring harvest, props are a bit don't focus enough on that side of things, leave too much to chance perhaps sometimes, but you can always learn. There's always stuff to learn.
It's probably my biggest regret actually in the whole course, and it was a fine balance between, because time off farm is great, but time on farm is incredibly precious, and you've got to remember who you've left behind holding the baton, so we didn't want to sort of take too much time away from you, but I do regret not having a bit more just time for you guys to talk and sort of do more. We have almost traditionally taught a little bit, and obviously that's a fine balance, because you don't want to, we need to teach people to be better managers. That's not what it is. You know, we've talked before about, you know, if I turn around and say, oh, Reynold, you need to manage your farm better, that's like saying you've got an ugly baby.
Yeah.
You know, it's not fair, it's not nice, and
it could be true, though. I'm not saying it here. I'm just saying it.
With other people. Because the way it came across, I was like, well, it's a good job you finished that cake, because you don't get any more.
Yeah. Just to clarify, you might not say it as it's an ugly baby, but sometimes people need a little bit of help realising how we can make that baby prettier. of the importance of needed to make it.
This thing, you know, as a euphemism goes, you should probably duck out.
Yeah, it's contextual or contextual.
Yeah, no, I mean, I had a conversation with somebody the other day and about the importance of sort of, particularly given how challenging farming is, the need to accommodate farmers. And I thought that was a really poor choice of words. And I don't think it wasn't how they meant it or various other bits and pieces. But actually, the last thing that we've ever wanted to do is accommodate farmers. We want to understand. We want to empathise. But actually, part of my job is to make them just uncomfortable enough that maybe something will shift and change. But not to the point where I just come across as a bit of a knob. Because that's a natural state of being.
You haven't done that often.
No, once a week, maybe.
For a 4-day block.
Oh yeah. It's like saying I've only ever been drunk once, I just never sobered up. Yeah. Very similar. I think there's an element of that. I mean, Sean actually was very when he did his section, he was, you know, if you're not looking to change, not necessarily massively, but a little bit all the time, yeah, then you're already behind. You know, you can't stand still. But at the same time, it's got to be about your business first. Yeah. It's a business driver that sort of pushes things forward.
Like, just from our point of view, I couldn't see we could really lose, like, even if you learn what not to do.
Oh, he wasn't asking you to spend anything, was it?
Yeah, no. So you always learn something, isn't it? So.
Moving into something where there probably was a chance of losing, and it was a high risk. And I am actually, I mean, you said this before we started recording earlier, that it was slightly your fault. And yeah, I'm going to say it's your fault, the whole thing now, in front of everybody, the whole soy free Labrino was Reynolds' idea. No, but on a serious level, obviously, because you wanted to do the right thing, well, that's how it came across to me, because you wanted to do the right thing, and because there was a possible sort of, you know, yield benefit bits and pieces, when we met, so before even starting this job, you guys were already looking at soy-free diets. Yeah. For various reasons, you agreed to stay doing that, and we talked about various other bits and pieces. My first question is, obviously, we've talked about why you went soy-free, but are you all right to sort of give us an overview from sort of your perspectives? Why? What was the driver of going soy-free? Because you'd already done it before I'd said total ban in 2027.
Yeah, no, that's right. We were... couple of reasons, really. You started sort of niggling away at the back of my head. It seemed to be gathering a bit of traction in social media and stuff. And it's
the evils that are.
Yeah, and the guy, Ken Marsh, then our... the guy we bought our feed from, he had a couple of diets which were soya free already.
Yeah.
We just decided to try it. At the time, there wasn't a huge difference in feed price, so it wasn't a deal breaker.
Mm.
It did cost more, don't get me wrong. I think at the time it was about £10 a ton more.
But was there something to offset that Ken in his magic wisdom, because we had a little chat with Ken and he tells us all about his magic
yes.
skills.
No, that's right. So, and again, being on supplying Leprino, sort of we get heavily paid. So there's a lot of emphasis on fat and protein, solid levels. What? So on a solids contract, we obviously get paid for fat and protein. So that was one of the leading questions, is can we increase or add value to the milk by increasing milk solid levels.
Yeah.
So, to which Ken replied,
yes. Of course, yeah.
So that's why, so it sort of made the transaction a bit more comfortable, and there's been no sort of real difference. There's been no negative effect on yield or solids. In fact, you know, there's been an increase in milk output and solids. And I have to acknowledge, you know, the herd was quite young when we did move across to it, but
yeah.
So there must be an element of herd maturity
in that increase. Yeah, it's not the diet necessarily, and it's, well, certainly not in its entirety.
Its entirety, no. We definitely haven't seen any negative effects.
Yeah,
to go soy free.
So the best thing you can say is you're no worse off.
Definitely no worse off.
Which,
you know,
I suppose from my perspective was the best I wanted to achieve. It's not knack of people's businesses.
No,
and it hasn't across the soy pieces for everybody. I should point that out on this. I think I have on a few others. It hasn't always gone smoothly for everybody, but the vast majority, I think we're about 90-95%, there's been no problem or some slight gain.
Yeah.
And it is slight. You know, we've got to be honest here. It is slight. So that was where you were going before. So there was an element of doing the right thing. There was an element of sort of possibly
possibly sort of.
And yeah, and some of the other processes were sort of just coming down the line. So I just thought, well, we could try it on our terms first. And if it didn't work, we could just revert, I suppose. But we haven't reverted then. Yeah.
So has anything else helped potentially sort of within that? Or because obviously we've looked at various ways of sort of making this comfortable, or generally speaking, again, is the best we can say in this, you're no worse off.
You're definitely no worse off. You know, if you look at our milk profile over the last 4 years, solids and yield have improved. So, you know, I can't put a figure on how much of that is down to the diet, but
And obviously with the more mature,
So I can't. But there's definitely, you know, I'd like to think there's. It's been positive, isn't it?
It's
been a contributory factor.
Definitely, yeah.
So sustainability issues,
Gareth. And one thing I haven't looked at is urea levels in the milk. I don't know if they... I assume definitely in spring, urea has been lower, I would say, but I can't say that.
Suggesting some form of... I suppose it depends how low, isn't it?
Efficiency,
You want to see that sweet spot, sort of 175, 225, David Howard. Tell me that. I'll take his word for it.
So is that something you're thinking of doing into the next year?
Well,
testing for urea and
that's tested in the milk anyway.
That's right.
But I haven't collated that data.
Oh, okay. So it's actually the analysis of the data.
Yeah. If there's been a difference, I don't know.
Okay.
So in terms of broader sustainability, we should touch on this and give you guys a bit of credit. So, I mean, you guys obviously sort of pushing soy before I burdened everybody else with it. What else have you done? Because in aiming to do the right thing, either for your business or really for the planet, you guys have done a bit more than that, haven't you? You've got other things you've played with, toyed with, invested in.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a very nice, looks like a very snazzy swimming pool that I did when I was last here.
Yeah, we've...
The jacuzzi,
or the tennis court.
Pukuzzi, I think we call it. Pukuzzi.
Good one.
Yeah, it's warm. Instead of your hot tub.
So, yeah, in order to help comply with coming legislation, and we had to invest in slurry storage.
Yeah.
We decided to do an earth bank lagoon, which is lined. And then we put a floating cover on as well, and at the same time, which stops contamination of clean rainwater into the slurry. So we use that clean water then to wash the parlour down, to hold it down. We just run the water through a UV filter just in case there's any nasties in it.
Which is a nice touch, actually. It's not just keeping the rainwater out. You are actually then harvesting quite a volume of rainwater as well, aren't you?
Yeah, it's huge, really. Because I thought at the start it's going to be a nuisance to this water to get rid of, but we're using something like 10 cube a day through the volume washer, so
it's a thoroughly clean parlour.
Well, it's quite. I think it's quite a big deal, especially the way the summers have been going. There's lot less stress on the borehole.
I would say you're pulling water from the borehole as well. So yeah, you are looking after local aquifers.
So it's a big saving on, pulling a lot of pressure off the borehole.
Yeah,
I think the footprint of the lagoon then, with about 1.5 metres rainfall a year, it's 750,000 gallons of clean water.
It's a big swimming pool.
Worth swimming then, isn't it?
It's not going into the slurry, or we can harvest and utilise.
Yeah. Did we mention herbal lays? Should we mention herbal lays?
Yeah, you can do it, yeah.
What do you want to tell us about herbal lays?
I probably need to improve my management. Sort of mixed bag, really.
I think it's important to talk about these things honestly, though, because you've worked really hard to pull this together.
Yeah.
By your own reflection, there are bits that could have been done differently. We did this with Johnny with his magic beans.
Yeah.
We could listen to Johnny, and there were elements of that that were awesome. It's an utter triumph. Yeah. But to be fair to Johnny, he went, we'll also talk about the 40 acres that didn't that didn't work.
Didn't go that
one. So yeah, after year one, I was quite disillusioned with the herbal lays. I think a lot of that was how we managed. I tried to manage it the same as ryegrass, sort of. Same rotation length, try to force the cows to hit residuals, and that hit the milk tank immediately. So I was sort of almost ready to rip them out. And spring 19, almost ready to rip it out after 1 year. And I just sort of, first couple of grazings of the season, I just let the cows go and do what they did, and not worried about residuals. And it wasn't as bad as I initially thought.
Right, okay.
We'd been using 15% less nitrogen at the time on them.
Yeah.
And it's quite difficult to measure accurately with a plate meter, but they seem to be growing similar sort of density of forage. So, but again, I can't put an accurate figure on the growth rate. But yeah, I'm not sure on intensive grazing persistency. It's very difficult to get them to last. You know, the seed mixtures, they cost significant. Well, they cost more than. We've tried just plantain with white clover and quite a few other lays, and for the first 2 years you get a lot of plantain, or what it looks like, and it just, even the last couple of summers have been quite kind, I'd have thought, you know, not much poaching or anything, and they still, they disappear, so possibly,
You find any benefits in terms of worm burden and bits and pieces, because they do suggest certain herbs. You've got chicory in any of them?
Chicory in one of them, yeah.
Yeah.
But, no, I can't say that, really.
So from what you were saying about the soy and the slurry management, you were looking at things coming down the line, so those sort of regulatory bits. What was your motivation or your catalyst for the herbal lays?
It's probably a bit fashionable at the time, probably. Yeah, right. Curious, other people.
Curiosity.
Yeah, a lot of people talking about them. So give it a go. It probably could have used less nitrogen on them still, not really knowing at the time what I was doing, how to manage it. Probably more my fault, really. I think a dry stock farm, I think they've definitely got legs. I'm not sure, rotational grazing, unless you go all out and have at least a third of your platform, you know, so the cows are sort of proper use. It's a bigger, chunkier part of the diet. It is a benefit. I'm not sure. I don't know.
A bit more of a commitment needed, almost.
Well, almost. Mm. But
they talk about a third, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Eat a third, tramp a third, leave a third, move on.
Yeah.
But whether that works for your pastures is to be seen.
Yeah, ryegrass and clover are quite forgiving. Easy to manage. You know what you got. You're a bit more in control. You can graze it, cut it. You know, it can take a bit of stick and it still grows back.
It's a bit more work needed on those, but...
But, you know, it's, a lot of it's probably me then, isn't it? Or understanding the management of it. Yeah.
Possibly.
So Reynolds' experience seems really positive. And there are 9 more farmers like him that have found value from the Lean programme that is currently underway?
Yeah, and I'd like to think it's been a positive experience for all of the Lean farmers. I mean, we saved £1 million this year between the 10 of them. In terms of reductions in their cost of production. But we are still working on how to translate that into wider farm engagement. Michael obviously has some interesting theories on how we make continuous improvement more appealing. But I think we should also note that Lean isn't for everyone. The tidy women are dull. The flip side of that, the farming piece, and the great philosopher Humphreys, who I've already quoted in another sort of conversation, another episode, his catchphrase is, "You're only ever farming between fuck-ups." Which is almost the opposite of tidy women are dull, in that it almost gives this sort of sense of sort of ravagement and excitement of sort of, you know, sort of living on the edge of the next great yes, very much so, because that's not dull at all. This is why we live and breathe farming, because we're only ever farming between, you know, this, that and the other. But the flip side of that is it's exhausting, isn't it? It's absolutely exhausting. It's exhausting for the people doing it. It's exhausting for that labour pool that we probably can't keep and attract. It's exhausting for our resource, be that the animals or be the other bits and pieces. It feels, though, that's so ingrained in sort of what we do that there'll need to be some sort of, because not everybody's as enlightened as yourself and has been sort of absorbed into the cult of or potentially into the cult of Lean. You know, some of us are quite fixed in our mindset. It feels like there's either going to have to be a massive, great big kick that kicks us all to a point of uncomfortableness and we have to find it, or some leadership that's going to bring those people along and convince them that actually they're just uncomfortable enough or there's a better way. And this is my big thing is, Toyota managed to do that in the automotive industry, and the automotive industry is revolutionized compared to where it was. Probably not perfect, but, you know, various other bits. Where's that going to come in agriculture? Are we going to have to wait for some sort of potential catastrophic thing that's going to kick us all to it? Or do you think there could be or should be someone somewhere that should show the leadership to bring this to the masses. Who's our agricultural Toyota? Maybe it's Toyota. Maybe we should just bring them in.
There's a fundamental distrust of bringing something from the automotive industry to a farm, which is totally different. That is the that's what most farmers think. Yeah, but I don't know. I think it could come from the roots of farming. I think a few people, if we form a cult, and we can
Wayne's World 2, if you book them, they will come.
I'm thinking if some people actually did that, that's all you need to do. And I've been in knowledge transfer in agriculture for far too long. But I do think some people will never listen or never really need to change. But there will be, it's amazing how things spread, you know, and how
like a fungus.
Seeing is believing, and how people get interested in actually visiting a farm and seeing actually what could be, and actually envisaging, you know, what Jana said about what is perfect on your farm. I think it could be from the masses, you know, up, bottom up, rather than someone. That's again push and pull, isn't it? If it's leadership, definitely. If it's leadership from above, that's the whole, that's been the whole problem with efficiency from the start. Is it's
ironically pushed them into being more efficient, rather than their motivations pulling them into efficiency. I would love to see that. I remember there's a small part of me that loves to watch the world burn. And I remember we had a producer meeting and a farmer stood up and he went, "How dare you? How dare you give in to the vegan mafia and these bloody supermarkets that are telling us what to do in bits and pieces? What would happen if we stood up and in one voice said no?" And a small part of me at that point sort of swelled with pride. And I wanted to give him a clap and just go, yes, that sort of underdog spirit. Finally, someone is going to stick it to the man. And then I thought about it in that sort of microsecond. And I went, you know what? There's a small part of me that would love to see that. But I know what would happen. I said, all of our customers would stand up and in one voice would go, fine, I'm just going to buy something else. And you're just like, and it's shocking that's sort of there and various other bits and pieces, but sort of, you know, taking that as an example is sort of, we see sort of, you know, the uptake of things that are good ideas, 3-point linkage, GPS, you know, stuff that it's genuinely a good idea. The normal tick time for that in the agriculture industry from this is good to we're all doing it is between 40 and 50 years. We've got 7 before we need to see a 30% reduction in pre-farm gate emissions of 30%. I mean, that is world-shaking, life-changing, grand sort of, you know, shifts in sort of ways of doing. And don't get me wrong, it almost makes your 11 years seem quite luxurious by that. You know, you can put your feet up and have a day off for a little bit, you know, compared to that. And that's where I think sort of the leadership piece comes in. I mean, I wonder, can we afford to wait to be efficient?
Yeah, isn't it weird though? Because have you seen Don't Look Up, the film? When there's two scientists that find out there's a meteor.
It's a
very clunky.
Yeah, it's good.
Metaphor for climate change, but they're trying desperately to say, look, this isn't a problem. This is a problem, and everyone's sort of going la 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 la. Isn't that what farmers are doing? Like I'm doing that.
Farmers, I don't think it's just them. I think it's a loss of the supply chain. I think it's easy to kick farmers, but given how far removed they are from that end consumer and some of the concerns and various other bits, and they're so busy, I think yes is the short answer. They are, but I think we all are. I think we have to share some accepted responsibility in that.
So hang on. So who's saying the 30% reduction?
So this would come from scientists like those looking up at the meteor sort of imminently coming here. And that's translated into something called science-based targets. And those science-based targets would say that the vast majority of sort of businesses will be looking at roughly, and it is roughly, it depends on their baseline and their position and their rate of progress and distribution of emissions, but roughly a 30% reduction in sort of scope 3 emissions, those emissions coming from further down the supply chain, of which in the food sector, agriculture is 90-95%, or in our case, it's 94% of all the emissions in a block of cheese comes from, or is present. It doesn't come from the farm. It's present by the time it's flowed through the farm and is leaving the farm gate. Yeah. I mean, to say the farmer puts that in is obviously a falsehood. They don't. They put in some of that, and the cow puts in a chunk. But a lot of that is there coming in through their inputs, because they're quite a way along the supply chain. But 94%. So if you go back to the farm gate as a measuring stick in the flow of carbon, that's all it is. We need to reduce 30% of the carbon at that flow point.
Yeah.
That's 7 years, 2030, in order to reach that 1.5 degree warming. So we're still going to end up with global climate shift due to that warming. But it's the best case scenario is a 1.5 degree shift. And that's a 30% reduction. That's that's a conversation for another podcast series.
Absolutely.
In fact, we can have a super overarching podcast series just called Podcasts That Save the World.
Podcasts That Save the World. There we go. That's like a trilogy at least.
At least a trilogy. Definitely.
Brilliant.
Michael, we sort of normally ask sort of podcast guests, if we've done so many of these podcasts now, yeah. We're experts. We normally ask podcast guests, if you could give one pearl of wisdom, which is something that even saying it winds me up, because anybody who tells you there's a simple thing to change the world is either lying or trying to sell you something. But imagine you're one of those people. If you could give one pearl of wisdom, just a start point, something for somebody to just trigger what I call a brain fart, you know, that poof that hopefully doesn't leave you with a stink. What might it be?
I'm not going to sniff it anyway, so...
No, never sniff it first. That's the rule.
A pearl of wisdom.
A pearl of wisdom, yeah.
To start.
Yeah.
Well, I feel... Obviously, I feel such a hypocrite because... Yeah.
You've come this far, you may as well commit.
I'll tell you what, maybe this is it. I'm currently taking videos of what my sheds look like, what my office looks like, with a view to this is going to change.
Right.
I've already got a skip. And I'm actually going to, it's just little, I mean, I think there's an awareness. Everything I do now, I'm aware of, could I have done that process better? Because everything is a process, isn't it? On the farm. Could I have done that better? How could I have done that better? And at the start, you think, I'm not sure if I know how I could have done that better. But with practice, it's almost a sort of, it did originate in Japan, it's almost like a martial art.
Mm.
You've got to keep on practicing about looking at these processes, looking at the waste that you're actually, without knowing, creating, and just being aware of what you're doing and how you might be able to do that better and change the things that really annoy you first.
Yes, I like that. Change the things that really annoy you first, which hopefully isn't this podcast.
That is not original.
No, it's brilliant. And do you know what? Thank you so much, Michael, for spending the time with us and giving us those pearls of wisdom, genuine pearls of wisdom. It sounded sarcastic. The moment it left my mouth, it sounded like I was taking the mickey. I wasn't. It was sincere.
I'm now used to that, Ben. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
It didn't sound sarcastic at all.
Michael and I have shared a goose together. So we can do this. That again is a story for another podcast, but it's worth pointing out.
It's very nice.
It was very nice. Thank you very much, Michael. We really, really appreciate it.
Yeah. Brilliant. No. Great. Thank you.
So, podcast 4, and blimey, that was good fun, wasn't it? I mean, doing a podcast that was half recorded when we were on farm, really thanks again, Renat and Rachel, for hosting us on farm to record those bits with Dan and with David, and then the brilliant interviewing with Michael as well. So it was great fun. But you know what? It's real life stuff, isn't it? It's real life stuff we've been talking about. And that's what really matters, is how we've brought this to life. So, Ben, what are some of your take home messages from that podcast?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot covered. In fact, you know, obviously people listening to this will realise that there was probably some editing involved and all sorts, and we probably covered more. And obviously we had to edit out all of the snoring from excessive cake eating. So there was that. But there is a problem, I think. And this podcast, I suppose, highlighted some of the solution, hopefully. But the problem is, as allied industry, as supporters of the industry, as customers of the industry, in fact, I can list all of the people that sort of stand in front of a farmer at a different point. Policymakers could come under that, and advisors could come under that. We sort of look at them and we say, the most powerful thing you could do for your business, for your bottom line and for your business sustainability, is to become more efficient. As if they woke up that morning thinking, do you know what, I've got nothing better to do than grind my business into the ground. And I think talking to Michael, it became obvious. I mean, his is a very personal journey, but I've met plenty of Michaels who sort of realize that they're leaving a legacy. They want to leave something that is really meaningful, but they've only got so much time. Yeah. And I think however you sort of use the word efficiency or various other bits and pieces, really what we're doing is we're trying to value the time we put into something. And maybe value is a more appropriate thing, because it can mean the value given back to the environment, the value back given to the people and the families that rely on agriculture, and of course the financial value that we receive, you know, across the supply chain, because you know, some of us make a lot of money off of farmers. So that it was good to know that sort of, you know, there is that general ethos of sort of, you know, we all want to add value. I suppose talking through, because it was a bit of a personal one, this one, because myself and David and Dan then obviously has come in for this dairy point, have been working hard to try and deliver something that you can stand in front of a farmer and go, look, actually, we could do this and find you efficiency, rather than sort of kicking the tires and going, right, you fix that. Yeah. I'll come back and whinge at you when you've not done it. Rather than that, which I'm just sick of seeing, we put it out. And so to hear sort of from the farmers that actually had made a difference, and they sort of really engaged with it, and sometimes that was just a difference in time. I mean, picking out sort of behind the scenes, I mentioned this with Sawyer, but if I give you a summary of the whole piece, there were 10 farmers that undertook Lean, some of them actually we've heard from on other podcasts as well. Across those 10 farm businesses, there was £1 million, near as damn it, £1 million saved in this 12-month period across all of those businesses. And obviously the really bigger businesses saw some sort of higher returns, some of the smaller businesses saw less, but sort of proportionately it was pretty similar across them. Mm. And then for us as Leprina, I'll be honest with you, you know, we saw a 3-10%, you know, somewhere in that region. And again, it depended on sort of the nature of the business, reduction in carbon footprint, again, on those farms. So as a business, we didn't get nothing from this. You know, obviously there was a reason to do it, but the biggest overwhelming reason to sort of support this efficiency piece was to try and stop being part of the problem and try and be part of the solution. And if I'm being really, really honest, I think we recognize that without farmers, we've got no milk. Without milk, we've got no cheese, in which case we're not a viable business. So whilst there might not be a short-term financial return, increased resilience within the system is a huge financial benefit to Leprino and would be for others. So, I mean, my real hope is anybody listening to this and obviously hearing sort of what Raynaud and Rachel said and any of the other farmers where they do pick up on it, if you hear it and you think, my God, that'd be really good to sort of bring to our farmers, I think it's an open door. You know, myself, Dan, David, and obviously Neil, who wasn't on the podcast as well, you know, we don't own this sort of solution. You know, we're happy to scale it and share it and various other bits and pieces. You know, it's there, it's almost free, other than sort of some time to deliver on farm, of which I wouldn't see any money, but it's almost free to the industry to see. So it's, if you want to save your businesses, yeah, a huge amount of money and carbon in the process, we've got that piece, that mystery piece in the middle. You know, rather than telling farmers to be efficient, we can actually help them to be efficient.
Yeah.
So
help them, yeah, and support them along the journey rather than just laying down the law and going sort it out yourself. And that's really important.
Yeah, the other big one that came out of this whole podcast is, I mean, we talked about efficiency there, and it's worth pointing out, and we had this big conversation with Michael, didn't we? Efficiency can be a dirty word.
Absolutely.
I think the joy of the approach we've tried to take, or we've worked with the farmers, and the farmers have really developed this as much as we have, is about trying to, when you talk about efficiency, you talk about lean, which is it can sound very clinical and sort of manufacturing based. Is we've not forgotten about the humanity of it. You know, it's people that drive change. And the way that we've deployed lean management is about supporting the people to allow the change in their business, not shoehorning human beings into doing this and doing that, which is not natural.
And doesn't work, let's be honest. Yeah.
And I suspect that's why we've had some success so far. And I'd hope that it's scalable. So,
but scalable across all sectors as well. This isn't just something that fits with the dairy industry because you've made it prove beef, poultry, pigs, sheep, everything, even fish, aquaculture could actually be part of this as the broader solution. And yes, it's like you say, you've seen a decrease in carbon, but let's not get carbon tunneled about this. You know, there are probably other benefits that maybe just weren't recorded in this instance, but the human element certainly shone, I think, in this podcast. It really did. It shone through. And with Michael's thoughts on time and everything, just backing up the reason for doing it, essentially.
Yeah, definitely. Without a doubt. I mean, we have delivered it in pigs. Neil and David have delivered it in horticulture, including production, arable type production. Beef and sheep, it's been done in dairy probably a little bit before as well. So it's absolutely scalable, without a doubt. Yeah. And again, it leads us back to that topic of systemic barriers. We talked about economics as a systemic barrier. We've talked about data through all of the podcasts so far.
Absolutely.
And will do again. And actually sort of, you know, the right information from data is a systemic barrier. But what the lean did is not only did it help find some of those economics so that change actually was more manageable, but what it did is it allowed people, when they got the information from the data, to deploy that to deliver the value, i.e. deliver some money back.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at them as three separate barriers, that's one thing. But if you look at them as having interconnected solutions, whereas if you break down one in a certain way, it'll help to sort of liberate the others. That's more realistically how it works.
Yeah.
So lean can help, or this form of lean, other production management systems are the same, but supporting efficiency in a more holistic way can break down multiple systemic barriers. And that's how we'll get rapid change, you know, that meets all of the stuff we talked about in the first episode.
Yep. And rapid change is exactly what we need to hit some of these targets that we're, you know, there is no doubt that rapid change is needed. So brilliant. That was a great way to wrap up podcast 4. So as always, subscribe through your normal podcast channels or platforms, and make sure you don't miss out on the 5th episode coming out in 2 weeks' time. We will speak to you all then. Happy listening and goodbye.